Mark revisited number 42, and our text this time is Mark 14, 43 to 72. We're making our way through Mark's Gospel, and we'll reread the arrest, and then we'll go on to the end of the chapter. Mark 14, 43 to 72, the theme, abandoned by his friends. Mark 14, 30, 43. Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him was a crowd, armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." Therefore, going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. The men seized Jesus and arrested him. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. "Am I leading a rebellion," said Jesus, "that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you teaching in the temple courts, and you didn't arrest me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." Then everyone deserted him and fled. A young man wearing nothing but a linen garment was following Jesus. When they seized him, he fled naked, leaving his garments behind. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, the elders, and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death. But they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against Jesus. "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days will I build another not made with hands.'" Yet even then their testimony did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again the high priest asked, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," said Jesus, "and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." The high priest tore his clothes. "Why do we need any more witnesses?" he asked. "You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" They all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, "Prophesy." And the guards took him and beat him. While Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came by. When she saw Peter warming himself, she looked closely at him. "You also were with that Nazarene Jesus," she said. But he denied it. "I don't know, understand what you're talking about," he said, and went out into the entrance. When the servant girl saw him there, she said again to those standing round, "This fellow is one of them." Again he denied it. After a while, those standing near said to Peter, "Surely you were one of them, for you're a Galilean." He began to call down curses, and he swore to them, "I don't know this man you're talking about." Immediately, the cock crowed the second time. Then Peter remembered the word that Jesus had spoken to him, "Before the cock crows twice, you will disown me 3 times. And he broke down and wept. As we progress with his gospel, we're getting to know John Mark himself so much better. Trouble is, it makes me want to go back to the beginning and start all over again in order to use that knowledge. But don't worry, that's out of the question. First, I want to look now at Mark as an observer. Chapter 14 is, as we see, full of big matters. There's the supper, the agony, the arrest, the trial, and the denial. But it seems, as you read the chapter as a whole, that Judas and Peter are the main interest. In each subsection, they appear at the heart of things. First Judas, then Judas and Peter, After that, Peter and Judas in the next section. And finally, Peter alone in the courtyard weeping. The one is an apostate, the other a faithless leader. What is somewhat disconcerting is how similar in English the words are for both. Look up apostate in a thesaurus and you find deserter. But the 11 deserters are not apostates, that's for sure. Judas disowned Jesus, but exactly the same word describes Peter in the courtyard. He also disowned his master. Dr. Dick Franz puts it rather well. Mark does not directly explain the reason why Judas's defection is terminal, but Peter's only temporary. But perhaps the answer is to be found in part in the last word of which Peter is the narrative subject. He broke down and wept. His remorse, contrasted with Judas's apparently settled disloyalty, points to failure under pressure rather than a deliberate change of allegiance. And for that, Mark's readers will have noted with relief, there remains the prospect of forgiveness and rehabilitation. Now, how relevant all this was for the times when Mark was writing? It explains, I think, the prominence of Judas and Peter in Mark's record. Just as in the later New Testament letters, for example, to Peter and the Johannine letters, apostasy and spiritual collapses were becoming genuine concerns. Mark and his first readers will have been well aware of this, which makes this part of the Passion story so significant. Sad and distressing episodes like this, apostasy and spiritual collapse, were present from the beginning, and of course they remain permanent realities in the life of the church to this day. To define apostasy by simply quoting the Emperor Julian is hardly enlightening. It's all much closer to home than that. Talking of definitions, I turned two Bible theological dictionaries on my shelves to find three lines on apostasy in one and a couple of paragraphs or so in the other. I said to myself, do we fight shy of tackling this subject, or don't we think it's a serious issue? Well, let's wake up to the reality. Mark names Judas one of the 12, three times in this passage, one of the 12. Yes, out of one of the 12, that unique and original group of chosen men, one of them is an apostate. Fortunately, I then discovered a stimulating article on apostasy in Dr. R.C. Ortland's, written in the IVP's New Dictionary of Biblical Theology. I've come to find this book of great value, and I want to recommend it. A witness to the fact that I've used it so often is that my copy is already falling apart. I repeat, the New Dictionary of Biblical Theology, published by IVP. I find that Dr. Ortland is willing to provoke us, to thought. Here, for example, is a quote. Later theological systems, Calvinist or Arminian, may unintentionally blunt the edge of the theological witness, either by diminishing one's sense of the need to persevere, or by subverting one's confidence in God's commitment to and provision for the struggling saint. I rather like that phrase about blunting the edge of biblical witness. Every honest preacher of the New Testament knows the tensions here, as to how one preaches with equal seriousness both the promises of God and the warnings of God. The systems preacher must be in danger here, but the expository preacher ought not to be. I ask myself, looking back, did I take sufficient note and speak with sufficient emphasis on the awesome warnings of a book like Hebrews? I suspect that all too easily, and often unconsciously, these warnings are neutralized and undermined as hypothetical and not necessarily real and true. Here's a $64,000 question. Did the reformers sense the danger of systems preaching? Of course they were, to a man, Augustinians. But I've been looking again at Dr. Griffith Thomas's peerless book on the 39 Articles called The Principles of Theology, another book I recommend, though I think well out of print. In particular, I've been reading him on Article 17 of Predestination and Election. He reminds us that the Reformers taught predestination long before the time of Calvin, and that the Reformation movement itself was, in a sense, the product of this doctrine, rather than the doctrine being a product of it. Zwingli taught it even more clearly than Calvin, and Luther was as dogmatic as Calvin himself. Bucer taught the doctrine to Calvin, and Melanchthon first gave predestination a formal place in the Protestant system. Article 17, therefore, is totally Augustinian. No question of that. Yet after considerable length, there is a short final paragraph of great significance. You may judge it for yourself. I'll read it. Quote, "Furthermore, we must receive God's promises in such wise as they be generally set forth to us in Holy Scripture. And in our doings, that will of God is to be followed, which we have expressly declared unto us in the Word of God." Unquote. My interpretation of this is, in your study, dear preachers, be an Augustinian. But in the pulpit, be a Bible man, and you will best serve the flock and mislead nobody. Think then, dear pastors among you, that just as there was an apostate among the 12, there are likely to be future apostates in your church membership. They need the classic exhortations here and now, as indeed we all do. For example, see to it, brothers and sisters, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God, Hebrews 3:12. So, exhort the people of God that it is their responsibility to keep themselves in the love of God, Jude 21. Only then is it safe to affirm with them Jude's great doxology to him who is able to keep you from falling and to present you before the glorious presence without fault and with great joy. I also want you to notice that Mark is a pastor. Not only a shrewd observer, but an under-shepherd who protects and guards the flock. Consider the following. 1. In section 1, we discovered the best cure for apostasy, as verses 1, 2, and 10 and 11 wrapped themselves around the record of a devoted woman who loved the Lord and gave of her best. It was a good reason, after Peter's restoration, to think that he would remain strong and faithful because he could say, "Lord, thou knowest that I love you." 2. In section 2, after an unexpected warning, one by one of the future apostles, reclining round that famous table, says, "Lord, is it I?" For me, that's been a reminder that at the Lord's table is a very good time to do a bit of hopefully honest self-examination. We look back, we look up, and we look forward, but there's also a matter of looking in. That can be tough, before conversion and after conversion. Do you remember C.S. Lewis? "For the first time, I examined myself with a seriously practical purpose, and there I found what appalled me. A zoo of lusts, a bedlam of ambitions, a nursery of fears, a harem of fondled hatreds. My name was Legion." I don't see much of such conviction of sin around a day like that. But then, that's one of the reasons there is comparatively little robust Christianity without it. Third example. As the evening draws in, Peter, the brash and boastful, and prayerless Peter too in the garden, where sleep overcame him and the others, is a reason, a quite sufficient reason, why collapse was likely to follow. Humble yourself under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time, 1 Peter 5:6. If not, we shall certainly fall, and some from a big height, like Simon Peter. And another thing, very obvious, a commonplace in Christian experience, but I've been thinking about that courtyard again. When we find ourselves temporarily, or for a long time because of work, in an unbelieving or pagan setting, it's wise to make our position clear early on. For Peter, that might well have been risky, of course, but the likelihood is that it would have saved him a lot of agony. So what I'm saying is that in the end, Mark's stories about Peter and Judas must have been salutary warnings to tens of millions of Christians and people down the years. Mark is a pastor, and his labours will not be in vain. Mark, then, a shrewd observer and a wise pastor. And finally, as I look at this chapter, I say to myself, Mark is an honest-to-God reporter. I'm not saying this simply on the basis of the not unreasonable guess that the young man of verses 51-52, despite Papias, is John Mark. Consider first how frank Mark always is about the disciples and their grave deficiencies. They were apostles by the time he wrote his gospel. Matthew, by contrast, regularly softens the harsher criticisms and exposures. But Mark is honest and straightforward and tells us as it is. Consider, too, how very painful it must have been to spare his revered mentor, Peter, probably his spiritual father, to spare nothing in the telling of Peter's shame and weakness. Consider, three, how embarrassing the bold statement of chapter 6, verse 5 must have sounded to the early Christians. He could do no miracles there except by lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. Who would have invented that? Matthew again tones it down. Consider, four, the embarrassing 13:32, when Jesus declares his ignorance of the parousia. It seems so out of character, until you get the point, which many don't. All these examples show Mark as an honest-to-God reporter. So what shall we say about the hasty flight of the young man? Dear, solid and sensible Dr. Plummer says that this strange incident has so little to do with the narrative and is so out of harmony with the tone of it that we wonder why it has been inserted. But perhaps on this occasion Dr. Plummer is wrong. Suppose it's not out of harmony at all. I think Mark could be telling us that he was no better than anyone else that awful night. He's not going to stand in judgment of the others. His last glimpse, before he took to his heels, was of a calm, noble figure standing alone through all the turmoil, and with no one to stand with him, not even Mark the reporter. What Mark could not forget afterwards became his message: Jesus abandoned by his friends. And as Zahn says, Mark paints a small picture of himself in the corner of his work, and I would add, it's not a picture of a hero. From what we're getting to know about Mark, that would fit very well indeed.